You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a PhD holding historian, a professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that makes legit, seriously researched American history come to life through entertaining stories. Join me for a chronological telling of the United States story, from the Revolution to fractious Civil War, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way from 1776 to the early 20th century. Listen to History That Doesn't Suck on Spotify.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from the Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that because you're already listening to a podcast.
Useless information.
Hi, I'm Steve Silverman, and you're listening to a classic episode of the Useless Information Podcast. The story that you're about to hear is titled Jack the Stripper, and it was released back on March 20th of 2012. It was the third episode of the fifth year of this podcast, and it's a quirky crime story that I think you're really going to enjoy. I should add that it's a good thing that I'm going back and listening to these old episodes so many years later, and that's because the uploaded copy had a distortion in it. About 10 minutes in, it was just unlistenable to. But luckily, I still have the original recording that I made, and I've edited that into this file. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Useless Information Podcast, my collection of fascinating true stories from the flip side of history. My name is Steve Silverman, and today's story is titled Jack the Stripper. Now, before we do that, let's start with today's question of the day. And for today's question of the day, I thought I'd ask you about NASA's space station Skylab, which came crashing back to Earth in July of 1979. If you're old enough to remember it, its re-entry was quite the news story in its day. Now, pieces of it were scattered over a fairly wide area south of Perth, Australia. And as a bit of a joke, the Shire of Esperance fined NASA for littering. So how much did they fine NASA? Was it one, $400, two, $800, three, $1,500, four, $2,300, or five, $4,700? Again, how much was NASA fined by the Shire of Esperance for littering? Was it one, $400, two, $800, three, $1,500, four, $2,300, or five, $4,700? And as always, I'll let you ponder over this question for a bit, and I'll let you know the answer at the end of this podcast. And now for today's story titled Jack the Stripper. And this is a story that I stumbled upon a few months ago, and I found it to be very amusing, so I hope you do too. The story started making national headlines during the month of February, way back in 1960. And when I saw the headline, quote, Jack the Stripper prowls San Diego, I made the immediate assumption that some guy was flashing others around the city. But I was way off on this one. I was really wrong. The bandit dubbed Jack the Stripper by the city police pretty much had the same modus operandi every single time. Take, for example, the crime that he committed on the evening of February 21st in 1960. And by the way, that was a Sunday, if you're curious. It was on this night that the gunman, donning a rubber Halloween mask of a woman's face, walked into the bar at the Crest Inn and demanded all of the money from the cash register. He then asked all of the men, all four of them, I guess you can call it a slow night, oh, and I should mention that included the bartender, so it must have been a really, really slow night, to dump their wallets on the bar, and then he locked all four men into the restroom. Now, I know this sounds like the type of crime that is committed somewhere in the world every single day, probably every hour, but as with all the stories that I tell, this one has a twist. You see, Jack the Stripper always makes all of the women present at the bar strip naked. He then leaves with all of their belongings, and on this particular night, the one lucky woman happened to be 30-year-old barmaid named Jacqueline Joan Cantu. So let me ask you, if you were in her position, what would you do? You know, would you scream, run for your life? Well, not Ms. Cantu. She simply said, quote, "Oh no, not again," end quote. To which the bandit replied, quote, "Yes, ma'am, just like before," end quote. What you're thinking is correct. This was a repeat crime. He had robbed the same bar just 3 weeks earlier on Sunday, January 31st. His haul in the first robbery was $148. That's about $1,125 in today's money. But this time it was only $88.18. That's about $675 today. Now, the press didn't dub him Jack the Stripper for no reason at all. As you probably guessed, Ms. Cantu had to disrobe on both occasions. But this time she was taped to the table. So now's a good time for a joke. A guy walks into a bar and orders a beer. The bartender happens to be wearing a rubber Halloween mask. And then there's a naked woman taped to one of the tables. So what did the customer observe? The answer, absolutely nothing out of the ordinary. The only problem is this is not a joke. It really did happen. Afterward, the witness told the police, quote, "I thought she was a mannequin and that a masquerade party was going on," end quote. Now, I have no evidence to support my hypothesis, but I can only guess that this particular witness, if you can call him that, was drunk as a skunk. And Jack the Stripper didn't stop there. Just 4 days later, he robbed Tommy's Tavern for, get this, he robbed it for the fourth time. Now, I can't help but wonder where the police were in all of this. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to figure out which establishment he's going to rob next. This guy clearly had a pattern. Anyway, I diverge from my story. So here he is robbing Tommy's Tavern for the fourth time. And one female customer, a Mrs. DeLore, freaked out when she was ordered to strip. Refusing, the bandit started to rip off her blouse. She was left with no other choice, and she ultimately took her clothes off. A waitress at Tommy's Tavern named Gerlet Stoner had been forced to disrobe during two of the previous robberies. So she did the wisest thing possible. She had her schedule changed so that she could work the day shift instead. She figured that since the bandit was a creature of habit, you know, always robbing in the wee hours of the morning, she would be safe. Now, that almost worked, except that on this particular evening, she had been at Tommy's celebrating her birthday. I bet she never planned on spending her birthday wearing her birthday suit, if you know what I mean. While his shtick may have seemed incredibly predictable, and I hate to say it, monotonous at this point, his escape didn't go well at all. He took the keys to a customer's pickup truck and then sped away. That's when the bartender, a guy named Frank Caslow, grabbed a 410-gauge shotgun from behind the counter, took aim, and then fired at the escaping criminal. Caslow's aim was dead on, striking the truck's rear window right behind Jack's head. But for some reason, the blast was not powerful enough to do any damage. Meanwhile, a customer named Jerry White jumped into his own car and chased after Jack. About two blocks from the robbery, Jack abandoned the pickup and then fled on foot. White, armed with a pistol, took aim at the fleeing robber and fired two shots. Both missed the intended target. A total of 14 police cars, 6 from the Chula Vista Police Department and 8 from the San Diego County Sheriff's Office, hunted for Jack. They were too late. Jack got away this time, but just barely. Jack was described by police as being around 40 years of age, 6 feet tall, and weighing somewhere between 200 and 220 pounds. During each robbery, he was always polite, made sure to cut the phone line, and he never touched any of the women that he forced to disrobe in any inappropriate way. It was theorized that he left the ladies in the nude to inconvenience them so that they couldn't call the police. Now, this backfired a bit during one robbery when someone called the police to let them know that a naked woman was running up and down the street screaming at the top of her lungs. By the time the police arrived, Jack had a 15-minute lead over them. It should come as no surprise that the press was having a field day with this story. The March 7th, 1960 issue of the Titusville Herald joked, quote, "Jack the Stripper, the San Diego bandit, really puts some truth in the girl's long-standing complaint. But I don't have a thing to wear." And that's the end of the quote. And this is where the story of Jack the Stripper fades from the headlines. There was a story on March 17th about a robbery at a store named Jay's Display. The thief ordered a young clerk to disrobe before hitting her on the head and stealing $500. The police dismissed this as a copycat crime since our Jack was never violent and he only held up taverns at night. Fast forward to October 11th of 1962. A man entered a Southgate, California bar, which was owned by a 25-year-old divorcee named Arlene Van Note. He entered around 2 a.m. and asked for a beer. He then pulled out a gun and announced that he was holding up the place. $55 was taken from the cash register. As you can probably guess, the robber asked Miss Van Note and the bar manager, which was 35-year-old Joan Bagley, to remove all of their clothing. "I'm Jack the Stripper," he was quoted as saying. "I make my living this way." He supposedly threatened to rape Miss Van Note, but then said, "I'll put your clothes back on. I don't like women anyway." Ms. Van Note then put her clothes back on and was forced to tie up the still-nude Ms. Bagley. Then Jack did something he had not done during any of the previous robberies. He took Mrs. Van Note as a hostage and they used her car as a getaway vehicle. 8 hours later, the two were almost 300 miles away from the scene of the crime and they were at the Desert Inn Casino in Las Vegas. Mrs. Van Note whispered to a change girl that she was being held hostage and that the man she was with was armed. So the police were alerted and they descended upon a room at the Tam O'Shanter Motel that they had rented on the Vegas Strip. Now maybe it's just me, but I find it a bit humorous that Jack the Stripper was finally caught on the Vegas Strip. The police arrested Bobby Ray Watts. He was a 25-year-old, 6-foot-tall employee of a Huntington Park, California furniture company. He was ultimately charged in federal court with kidnapping and interstate transportation of a stolen vehicle. The judge in the case dismissed the charge on the stolen vehicle, and that's because the indictment handed down failed to mention that the car was stolen. And then Watts' lawyer challenged the kidnapping charge. He claimed that the indictment failed to state that Mrs. Van Note was being held for ransom or for a reward. Now, I don't know about you, but I consider kidnapping to mean being held against one's will, not whether or not a ransom is asked for. Now, as I bring the story to a close, I should point out that Bobby Ray Watts claimed that he was Jack the Stripper during this particular robbery, but it appears that they did not charge him with any of the other prior robberies. My guess is that either the police lacked the evidence tying him to those crimes, or he was just another copycat. Also, around the same time, another guy named Jack Wilkerson, who was also nicknamed by the press Jack the Stripper, was arrested for a similar string of robberies in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And of course, then there's the infamous Jack the Stripper murders in London between 1964 and 1965 that took the lives of 6 to 8 women. Useless, useful, I'll leave that for you to decide.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
And now, a few words from our retro sponsor.
Christmas is almost upon us, and this Christmas, as in the past 5 years, the finest gift you can give is a United States savings bond. They're the same safe, profitable government bonds we call war bonds, and bought regularly to help win the war. Young people enjoy receiving U.S. savings bonds because it gives them a feeling of having money of their own. Government bonds help give them a start in their college education or in their chosen profession. To older people, government bonds mean a future free from financial worry. They have a chance to make all of their retirement dreams come true. So for your own good and the good of the people you care about, keep buying United States savings bonds. You're lending your money to the government, and they'll pay you $4 for every $3 invested. And by the purchases of savings bonds, you're helping to fight inflation. Invest all of your spare funds in government bonds. By doing so, you'll be banking on your future. And now back to Erskine Johnson.
While he never achieved the fame of other competing gossip columnists, you know, like Hedda Hopper and Walter Winchell, Erskine Johnson did manage to hold his own. He was born Joseph Erskine Johnson in 1910 and wrote a nationally syndicated column starting in the late 1930s. His radio show ran under several names during the 1940s. It was originally called Hollywood Spotlight, then it became Tonight in Hollywood, and finally Erskine Johnson's Hollywood, which this commercial for savings bonds is lifted from. This particular episode featured an interview with actor Michael Redgrave and was originally broadcast on December 17th of 1945. It was broadcast on the Mutual Don Lee Network. A popular feature of Erskine's interviews was a segment that he called Hollywood Confessions. And that's where celebrities revealed something unknown about their lives. Now, there was nothing scandalous at all. You know, that is, unless you consider Roy Rogers admitting that he hated lemon pie to be a shocking revelation. I certainly don't. In this episode, Michael Redgrave confessed that he almost ruined his first screen test. There was some annoying sound on the movie set. It turned out to be his teeth chattering from the cold. So they warmed him up and he successfully completed the screen test. Erskine Johnson wrote his newspaper column for 31 years. He wrote his last column in July of 1967. He then retired to manage the Harbor Lights restaurant, which he owned in Oceanside, California. He died in 1984 at the age of 74. And now for a few totally useless, yet totally true tidbits from history. It's time for what I like to call News of the Weird Past. And before I get going, I should tell you that all of today's tidbits have one thing in common. They're all about absent-minded people. And our first story for today is dated September 10th of 1928. It was reported that a guy named William Jones and his family stopped at a service station in Chicago, Illinois, to have their car checked out. Now, while the car was being examined, Mrs. Jones decided to go to the bathroom and wash her hands. When she was done, she was shocked to see that the car was gone. It turns out that her husband drove off with their two kids asleep in the back seat. Now, my guess is he didn't get too far before he realized that he had forgotten his wife back at the filling station. I'm guessing those kids were screaming. Our second story is dated August 30th of 1960, where it's reported that a 79-year-old man named Maxim Radin checked into the Hotel Ashley in New York City. He was on his way back to his native Yugoslavia after having spent the previous 50 years working as a barber in California. Raiden paid his $12 for a two-day stay at the hotel, unpacked his bags, and then he decided to go for a walk. Now, this is a really big mistake on his part. You see, he was unfamiliar with the big city, and he lost his bearings and could not find his way back to the hotel. Even worse, he forgot the name of the hotel. So for 2 days, he wandered the streets trying to locate the building, but he, nothing looked familiar. He was unsuccessful. So finally, he had no choice. He went to the police. But with no name to go by, they just simply drove him around the area until Raiden finally spotted what he thought was his hotel. So he went up to his room, put the key in the lock, and opened the door. To his shock, all of his possessions were gone, which included his life savings. This included $11,067 in traveler's checks, $3,800 in hard cold cash, $600 worth of $20 coins, a bill of sale for his Oakland apartment building, his passport, and of course his ticket back to Yugoslavia. Raiden made the only logical conclusion anyone in his boat could make. He had been robbed. He had just enough money hidden in his money belt to pay for a flight back to California. But luck was on his side. It turns out that his luggage was not stolen. The manager of the hotel had put all of Raiden's belongings into storage, everything except the one suitcase containing the money and the valuables. Now, that suitcase was later found hidden under the bed by two boys, 11 and 13 years old. And they were, of course, the sons of a couple that rented the room after Raiden had left. All of his possessions and his life savings were returned to Raiden, and he set sail on the very next boat to Yugoslavia on September 16th. Now, my guess is that he was certain to remember the name of the hotel he was staying at when he returned to New York for that voyage. And our last story for today is dated May 6th of 1954, which reported that an unidentified man accidentally left a package containing $40,000 in cash on the back seat of a taxi cab. Now, that's a lot of money today, but to put it in perspective, that would be about $334,000 in today's U.S. Currency. Now, the cash was wrapped in a plain brown paper cover. Now, the passenger immediately realized his error and hailed a second taxi to go after the first one. But when they finally caught up to it, he found out that they'd been tailing the wrong taxi cab. The rider then got in touch with the vice president of the taxi company, and then he was able to get in contact with the taxi driver. The driver, Rocco Bologna, had found the package shortly after the passenger got out, and he placed it unopened by his side on the front seat. The package and its owner were reunited shortly thereafter, and in return, he was rewarded with a $20 bill. Now, $20 may have seemed like a really big tip at first, but my guess he didn't find it so big and generous when he learned that the package really had $40,000 in it. And now for the answer to today's question of the day. And I had asked how much NASA was fined by the Shire of Esperance for littering when the space station Skylab crashed back to Earth. And I gave you five choices. They were one, $400, two, $800, $3,1500, $4,2300, or $5,4700. The answer is actually the first choice, $400. Now, since the entire Skylab program costs about $2.2 billion, that's about $10 billion today, you would have thought that NASA could have sprung for another $400, but they never paid. And of course, the whole thing was a bit of a lark, so the officials of Esperance just wrote the whole thing off 3 months after Skylab's return. Now, fast forward to 2009, that's 30 years later, and the bill was still unpaid. So the highway radio program Barker and Barley in the Morning picked up on the unpaid bill, and they decided to have a fundraiser. Their listeners donated the needed funds, and the littering fine was finally paid off in April of 2009. So I guess 30 years late is better than never. Well, I hope you enjoyed today's story on Jack the Stripper, as well as our question of the day regarding NASA's littering fine, listening to our retro sponsor on U.S. savings bonds, and the news of the weird past tidbits, which included the guy that forgot his wife at the gas station. I actually had a second story like that, so I guess it happened more than once. Also, the absent-minded barber, which is my favorite of the three, and the $40,000 cab ride. As always, if you'd like to read more true stories just like these, please be sure to get a copy of one of my books. They are Einstein's Refrigerator and Lindbergh's Artificial Heart. Both are written by me, Steve Silverman, and they're available from your local bookseller, online, and from your local library. You can also find additional resources, including some of the scans of the documents that I used to research the story, some additional comments I have on the podcast, and some related links on my Facebook page, which is www.facebook.com/uselessinformationpodcast. That's Useless Information Podcast. It's all one word. Now, I've kind of been absent from Facebook. You may recall that I had cut my finger and got some stitches on it. Those came off, and then we bought a washer and dryer for President's Day, and we didn't have a laundry room yet. That was still under construction, so I had to put up all the wallboard, spackle, paint, and put down the ceramic tile and finish some of the plumbing before it showed up on Saturday. It did show up, and that project's done, and then I was able to work on this podcast. I did not post the information last month, but I promise that I will do it this time. Anyway, if for some reason you'd like to contact me, simply drop me an email at useless@steve.silverman.name. That's useless@steve.silverman.name. Or you can visit my website, which is uselessinformation.org. You can also go to Facebook and contact me through that. Well, I'd like to thank you again for listening, and I hope that you tune in the next time. Bye.